Members, I'm going to call the redistricting committee to order. And I think Representative Dowd, are you going to move the minutes for us today, please?
I most certainly would like to move the minutes.
Thank you. Representative Dowd moves the minutes from March 8th of 2011. Members, any corrections or comments on them? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? And those prevail. And those are approved minutes for March 8th of 2011. Members, today we are going to hear from a collection of different groups that are interested in the redistricting process. And I think at this time, Mike Dean, if you want to come forward, and please state your name for the record.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mike Dean. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota. I have just a presentation that I thought I'd walk through to really sort of help define the redistricting process. It's fitting that the committee is actually holding this hearing during Sunshine Week, because it's a national, for those of you that aren't familiar with what Sunshine Week is, it's a national initiative to really promote dialogue around the importance of open government. And so it's important that we spend some time focusing on the principles of openness and transparency, especially when we talk about redistricting, the redistricting process. Openness and transparency in government is critical to the strength of our representative democracy. Without these principles, government is more prone to corruption and undue influences because of the lack of oversight. As U.S. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis said, referring to the benefits of openness and transparency in government, sunlight is the best disinfectant. That is why the issue tends to be supported by both sides of the aisle. But more importantly, openness and transparency are key to ensuring accountability, whether that is accountability in the free market or with free governments. Having the knowledge to make informed decisions is at the heart of our society, but we can't take it for granted. That's why Common Cause, the League of Women Voters, the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, and Take Action Minnesota created Draw the Line Coalition. The coalition is focused on improving the redistricting process through the following principles. Specifically, creating an independent and nonpartisan group reviewing it, having the process be transparent to the public, also providing tools that would allow for direct input over specific plans under consideration. Four, you know, the redistricting process must be reflective of the diversity of the state, especially racial and ethnic diversity. And then also the last principle of the redistricting plan should preserve communities of interest. There appears to be common agreement within the committee on fairness and transparency and citizen input. Here are two quotes from both Representative Anderson and Representative Murphy publicly stating their support for these key principles. The challenge is moving beyond statements and developing a redistricting process that actually is fair, open, and has meaningful citizen input. Before we discuss that, it's important to acknowledge some of the challenges that the current redistricting process is facing. First, the process has largely been a failure. In the last 40 years, the legislature and the governor have been unable to agree on a new map. However, the 1990 map did make it through the process because of the failed veto by Governor Carlson. But over the last 40 years, the redistricting process has mainly happened in the courts. This has protected the state from any large-scale gerrymandering that we too often see in other states. But there has been a real lack of transparency and citizen input in that process as the courts handle it, mainly because it's not the nature of the courts to do that. There is also some inherent problems in the redistricting process that leaders of both of your political parties have spoken out about. Here's former President George Bush talking about the need for reforming the redistricting process. Specifically talks about that this would make it more competitive for general elections and less polarized Congress, making the change that would require politicians to give up some of the power, though, is never an easy task. And then here's current President Barack Obama talking about how too often representatives are selecting their voters as opposed to voters selecting their representatives. That is a situation I think that the American people should not accept. Some of the other challenges that face the redistricting process really are around the public perception of it. They're largely unaware of this process. A paper in the Election Law Journal in November of 2010 looked at public attitudes around redistricting. They analyzed a variety of public opinion polls and concluded that the public has a low level of knowledge and information about the redistricting process. The research also found that the public is less likely to view the redistricting process as fair, yet the final lines are drawn by partisan body. There are huge challenges that the committee will face in carrying out the redistricting process. How will you build trust in the process that the public believes is flawed, especially when voters in Minneapolis, California, Florida all supported referendums that limit the ability of partisan actors to draw the lines? The final challenge that you face with the redistricting process is really the timeline. You currently have less than 10 weeks until the end of the 2011 legislative session to draw the lines. Considering where things stand, it will be extremely difficult to draw the districts in a fair, transparent manner that allows for meaningful citizen input. Contrary to statements made last week, the Minnesota Constitution is actually quite vague on the redistricting process. It does not guarantee fairness, transparency, or citizen input. Over the years, the courts and the legislature have identified additional criteria that you must follow when drawing the lines. Here's some of those. And you've heard from Mr. Gillespie and Mr. Gehring talking about these criteria. With this level of vagueness, it's critical that the redistricting committee better define that process. There are three areas that the committee should focus on. One is fairness, two, transparency, and three, citizen input. Let's first talk about fairness. With fairness, there are a few opportunities to add in additional criteria. One of the handouts that we passed out talked about sort of districting principles. And I think it's really important that you, as the committee, define what those principles are. Some of that is guided in statute, some of it's guided in court precedent, but as the committee, you can go beyond that. And I think there's some additional criteria that are worthwhile for you to consider, whether that's creating a process that's incumbent neutral, where you purposely don't look at where incumbents currently reside in the process. California currently has that in its process. Two, look at political fairness, where you'd actually require that there be some level of political fairness in the final map. And then the third is competition. And this is an area that was brought up repeatedly during the 2001 process, specifically with the Ventura Commission that was created, where they really focus on creating competitive legislative districts. The second area focuses more on transparency. So there's a few recommendations that we have in here to how you can bring about greater transparency. The first is really to adopt and define principles at the beginning of the process. And I would really encourage you to start having that process happen right now. That will be important because it will provide sort of a roadmap in which you'll make key decisions later on. If you don't have that roadmap, it's going to be extremely difficult process later on because you won't know exactly where you're going. This is one of the recommendations that the National Conference of State Legislatures make in the process. Some of you attended their conference earlier this year, and I think that was one of the key takeaways, is not only to adopt, but then also to define. And in one of the handouts, we start the process and lay out some general ideas on how you could define that. The districting handout is based largely off of Senator Pogemiller's redistricting reform bill. But I think that is a good place to start from as you move forward. The second area of transparency is really that all the business around redistricting only be conducted in public session, and that all those comments and data are on the record and publicly available. That level of transparency is critical to ensuring that the public has faith in the process and that they don't feel like it's being a gerrymandered process at all. The third is that there be, public notice, basically 14 days for any public forums that are being held to give adequate opportunity for people to come out. I also think as you move forward with additional public hearings, to vary when the public hearings are being held. So far, they've only been in the middle of the day. For most individuals that work, it's a real challenge for them to attend those type of hearings. And so if you want broader public attendance at those meetings, more than just local elected officials, I really think you need to consider having them in the evening or on the weekends for individuals to participate. The fourth area is really a ban on any type of ex parte communication, really between legislators and their staff. This would ensure that, again, information isn't being shared back and forth that should not be. and that certain legislators aren't giving an advantage over another. Next is really to develop and maintain a public website. And this is what you're seeing a lot of states start to do to help build, again, additional trust and transparency in the process. Florida is probably the most extensive so far. Their House of Representatives has actually created a website that allows individuals to draw their map and submit those maps to the public. And we think that's great because technology really allows individuals to do that. It would encourage you to look at ways to make the public much more engaged in this through such a website. And also make sure that it's functional and accessible to members of the general public. It's also important that as information is dispersed to the public, one of the key things is what's going to happen this week is when you get the census data. That census data, it's important that the public have access to that same data that you're using or you're going to be considering during the process. And so making sure that's available along with all the demographic, political, and other data that you'll be considering as part of the redistricting process. And again, that helps bring greater transparency to the entire process. Then also creating an opportunity where comments can be received by the committee through that website and then shared with the public. Here's just a few remaining pieces along transparency. The next is really releasing any sort of preliminary plan. This sometimes has been done by the legislature and other times it has not been done. And I want to emphasize that I think this is really the most critical. That you provide basically a preliminary idea of what the plan will be and allow for the public to basically review that plan, providing adequate time to review that plan, but then also taking public comments during that. The courts, unfortunately, have not really done this in the past. And this really allows people to provide input that maybe gets lost in the process. It's really hard, I think, for members of the public to really understand where you're going with the redistricting plan until they actually have a map physically in front of them. And so releasing a map, again, for a two-week public period is really critical to that. Then as part of that, when you do release both that preliminary plan and the final plan, creating a report that outlines kind of why you made these decisions. That sort of level of justification, I think, is really key to informing the public how you made certain decisions, and again, bringing greater transparency to that process. And then the last part is providing public notice if you intend to adjust any of the census numbers and then state reasons why. This may happen anyway because occasionally the census messes up, the numbers aren't completely accurate, and so they have to make some adjustments. But I think it's really important that public notice be given during that process. So next or last is really citizen input. So really facilitating public comments and public submission, I think, is important to get a broad, diverse opinions on the redistricting process. You've begun that with some public meetings, but again, through both testimony in committee hearings, but then also through the internet, I think you can get a broader array of opinions about how individuals really define communities of interest and define their own individual community. Also, as partisan citizen input, really think it's important that you have at least three public meetings prior to the release of the plan, which you've actually already accomplished, so I applaud you for that. But then also having those public meetings after that draft map is developed, so that the public can, again, ask questions of committee members so that they can better understand how the decisions were made. And then it's also important to have committee meetings spread out throughout the state, and you've started to already do that. So specifically, what are we asking for as a coalition or recommending to the committee? I think there's really five steps that I think are important to help build that public trust in the process. Really, step one is to begin to set rules for that process. Right now, it's very much a blank slate. I think folks are extremely unclear about sort of how things will move forward. Now, the challenge, obviously, has been you don't have the map. You don't have the information from the Census Department. But it's important, I think, to really to create a timeline with target dates and how the process will proceed. You know, do you intend to have a final map before the end of the legislative session, or is this something where your timeline is more longer than that, and you intend to actually have a plan developed not until February of 2012. Step two is really to agree on sort of that set criteria in that priority order. So those criteria, again, are compactness, contiguity. Again, some of those are outlined in statute. Some of those you could throw on additional criteria. But really to outline what criteria you as a committee are going to adopt, defining those criteria, and then also I think it's important to have public meetings on those criteria so that people can weigh in on what they feel is important and what they feel is not. Step three is to create public engagements around the hearing and then the website and allow for that public testimony and even submissions of maps via the website. Step four is that the plans will be developed basically in open meeting throughout the process. And then step five is releasing a draft plan for a two-week public review period. And that you'll hold at least three hearings then on that proposed map. So at this point, what I'd like to do is pause, see if there's any questions, and then pass it off to some of the other testifiers.
Sure. Well, thank you, Mr. Dean. I have a couple of questions for you just to start off with. I'm looking at the talking about drawing the line, Minnesota Coalition, and you talk about that the process should be independent and nonpartisan. Can you tell me what you mean by that? What is your definition of independent and partisan?
Our ideal scenario, and we've been advocating for this from the beginning, would be an independent redistricting commission, similar to that has been proposed in legislation by, I believe, Senator Pogemiller and Representative Simon.
So when you're saying independent, you're saying that this would be appointed by a judicial, retired judicial panel. What can you give me a little more specifics?
The way it's defined in the legislation is that the individuals would be appointed by the leadership of both the House and Senate of the Minnesota Legislature. And so it would be
Mr. Dean, so what you're saying is that you think it's more important that the four leaders of the caucuses make that decision versus all 201 legislators. Is that what you're saying?
I think, though, in reality, not necessarily all 201 legislators are part of the final decision when it comes to this. They're not really the ones drawing the maps. And the way that it's outlined in the legislation is that the leaders would choose retired judges to sit on this commission, and then that commission would then forward its recommendations onto the full legislature to then have a final yes or no vote, similar to basically what happens with the current process where the committee here along with staff develop a series of recommendations and then forwards that on to the full legislature.
Well, thank you, Mr. Dean. I guess I don't have as much faith with my leaders in delegating that responsibility to them to do that. I like the option that we as legislators are able to vote on it, all 201 of us versus just four. I think my constituents would feel that way as well. And I'm just curious, too. I mean, when you talk about the having the retired judges, what makes them independent or nonpartisan? Do they not vote, or can you give me some ideas of what your thought process was there?
I think the main crux of the problem with the current system is that there's a conflict of interest when elected officials basically decide who their voters are going to be. And so the problem right now is that you all are deciding who your voters are going to be and choosing districts that you eventually are going to run in 2012. What we've seen happen in a lot of Western states over the last decade, really, is a move to these independent commissions where it's individuals that aren't directly impacted by the decision, meaning they're not going to be the people basically running for those seats. And having that level of independence creates better districts. And I think we've seen that in Arizona. I think we're going to see that in California here.
Isn't it true, though, Mr. Dean, that the voters choose us to be their representative?
But I think it's really difficult to have accountability when you craft a district that those voters that voted you in last election now are totally different. And you created.
Actually, Mr. Dean, the voters that voted us in were chosen by the courts. It was our courts that did that, so we didn't actually get to choose them in that circumstance. Just on a couple of other things that when you're talking about the judges, are these judges then that would not have been appointed by a governor, say, for example, that these are. What judges are we talking about that would serve on this panel?
So the way that it works, and I would hope that you would actually create an opportunity to have a full hearing on this. My intent today was mainly to focus on the process going forward. Mm-hmm. But I think that there should be hopefully an opportunity to discuss this in more detail. The way it's outlined in the legislation is that it would be basically both district court judges and appellate court judges would be able to sit on this commission. and the leadership would choose from that pool.
Okay. Members, anybody else have questions at this moment? Representative Garofalo? Murphy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I have to apologize. I have a committee to go chair here, so I'm going to try to just get through all my questions if I could right now, if that's all right. Can you go back a couple slides?
Sure.
I just want to make sure I read it right. Keep going. Keep going. Stop. Okay. Fairness. Incumbent neutrality. What does that mean?
That you're not looking at where incumbents currently reside when drawing districts.
And Madam Chair, go ahead.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, and to the testifier. So if that were the case, wouldn't individuals who represent high-density areas be at a far greater likelihood of being redistricted in with another incumbent than those from suburban and rural areas, just as a matter of mathematics?
Mr. Dean?
It is definitely possible. This is a principle that Iowa has adopted in its process. Obviously, it doesn't have the same density as Minnesota, where it's less of a problem. But we think it's important to look at this as you know, legislators currently are renting the districts. They don't necessarily own the districts. And so to create a district around an incumbent, we think creates bad policy. And that really, when developing the map, you should really look at communities of interest, compactness, other criteria are critical to that process and should be looking at those incumbents.
Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, and to the testifier, but I'm not talking about what's possible and how the lines are drawn, but as a matter of mathematics, I mean, my district mathematically where I live, you can't put me with another incumbent. It's mathematically impossible because I live in a low-density area. However, in high-density areas, people live city blocks apart from each other. So putting that standard in play would actually significantly disenfranchise or put incumbents at risk in high-density areas. Is that what you're advocating for?
Mr. Dean?
We're advocating that you don't look at where legislators live. And I think that, again, that's a bad public policy. There are ramifications of that. I'm not sure if the ramification you allege would actually occur. I think there are some rural areas where legislators live relatively close to one another, and they could potentially be put in the same district. But we would encourage the group to just not look at where incumbents live at all as just a policy perspective.
Representative Graffel.
Madam Chair and the testifier, second point, political fairness. What does that mean?
Mr. Dean?
That districts are not purposely created to advance one party or the other.
Representative Graffel.
Madam Chair and to the testifier, explain to me what that means. How does a district in Delano or Wright County or a district in Minneapolis or St. Paul, instead of just having a higher partisan index, being drawn for political advantage? What is the distinction between those situations?
Mr. Dean?
The issue in what we've seen happen in other states, again, this hasn't happened in Minnesota because the courts have largely drawn the maps, but California is a classic example where political parties, Republicans and Democrats, come together and create maps to basically protect incumbents. And through that, that's part of this sort of political fairness where they create districts that benefit Republicans or they create a district that benefits Democrats. By adding this criteria, it would actually prevent you from doing that in a purposeful manner, which is what we've seen in other states.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, and to the testifier, so in this situation, determining what would be the political makeup of a precinct, I covered this in our last hearing. I have a precinct in my district where I've gone from 57 to 52 to 44 to 61. That's one precinct in my district, and that's what I've done. In that situation, how would you assess the political makeup of that precinct?
Mr. Dean?
I think it's more about the process in the end. The process is, when legislators are creating the districts, are they creating them in a way to benefit one political party or the other? There's currently nothing that prevents you from doing that right now. There's nothing that forbids it. And so, yes, inevitably, you're going to create districts that benefit one party or the other. The question is, was it done on purpose or with intent to where it's not happening in maybe 20% of the districts are benefiting one party and or the other? That, you know, what sometimes you see is 40 or 50% of the districts are clearly created to benefit one part or the other. And when you get into that realm, then you can basically demonstrate that there was an intent to violate sort of political fairness doctrines.
So,
Representative Garofalo.
So, Madam Chair, and so I understand, it's not necessarily that we draw the districts based off of what the election results were 2, 4, 6, or 8 years ago. It's more about, you're talking about this transparency of making sure that people have an input in the process, that we're listening and we're drawing the lines. Is
Mr.
that correct?
Dean?
Not necessarily, though, because what you could do is, the question is, of the 130-some House districts, are 60 created in a way that benefit Republican, and are 60 created in a way that benefit Democrats? And if that was done, I would argue that there was not political fairness in drawing those maps.
Okay, but Madam Chair and Mr.
Representative Grossman.
Okay, I just outlined a precinct in my district where it is, to categorize my percentage of the vote as anything other than schizophrenic would not be accurate. It is all over the place. How do you, because I thought you and I were reaching agreement on this, and then you kind of backed up and said, no, we got to, when you're looking back at a precinct in that example where the vote total is up, down, how do you rate for me how that makeup of that precinct is? How do you determine if it is fair to be benefiting me, because in two years, or as a Republican, won it strongly, 2 years, I got the snot kicked out of me. Rate for me the fairness of that precinct.
Mr. Dean?
Well, I would argue that that's an extremely competitive district.
Okay, so, Madam Chair. Okay,
Representative Gruff.
And that is not the problem that I'm envisioning in this type of, adding this type of criteria.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Dean, so in that precinct, there is literally a 16-point swing in terms of Republican and Democrat performance. And my guess is if you look at a vast majority of the precincts in the state of Minnesota, that's the way they behave. If you look back at 02, 04, 06, and 08, and 010, you look at those five elections, that's what you're going to see. So given that swing then, using your concerns about political fairness and not benefiting one side or another, how do you do that? By definition, you just described a majority of the precincts as being competitive and not being a problem. How would you address that?
Mr. Dean?
Again, because the courts have largely drawn the maps, we haven't experienced the problem that we've seen in other states. And so the issue here is a good number of the districts have been created in a way that have been competitive. My worry is what happens down the road, and especially as legislators, you're very much interested in developing the maps this time around, that our maps going to be drawn in a way that benefits one party or the other, or creates a detente, which is what we've seen in states like California, where the parties basically agree that we're going to hold this number of seats, you're going to hold this number of seats, and we'll have this small, narrow number of seats be competitive, and that's what we're going to fight over. And the problem is, and President Bush alluded to this in his comment, is that pushes both parties to the extremes. And you have these non-competitive districts where it, you know, basically the fight is between Democrats or the fight is between Republicans, and you don't have representatives that necessarily completely reflect the interests of their constituents. Now, I would argue in your district, being competitive, you're much more receptive than some legislators to the concerns of your district because you've had very competitive elections. In other districts where they're not competitive elections, they're going to be less concerned and less able to listen to those constituents.
Representative Garofalo?
Madam Chair, my final question. Actually, I did not have a competitive election. I got almost 66% of the vote. So I was describing one precinct in my district. You mapped out a scenario of 120 districts kind of being carved out Republican and Democrat. Do you have any examples you can cite so far through this process where Representative Murphy or the chair have been communicating that or been engaging in tactics that would lead you to believe that this legislature is doing that?
Mr. Dean?
In Minnesota, no, but it's happened in other states, and that's what we're concerned about coming here.
Madam Chair, I have so many other questions I'd like to ask, but I need to get to the Education Finance Committee. So thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. Representative Murphy?
Mr. Dean, I just had a question about you. When you started off on that agreement on principles box, you talked about nonpartisan. How is and you talked about fairness and nonpartisan. Where does bipartisan fit in?
Mr. Dean?
I mean, in my ideal setting, it does not. And again, because some of us have a philosophical disagreement about the process. I think we've too often seen what, again, has happened in California being sort of the worst example of this, is where bipartisan has meant sort of the parties come together and create a large number of safe districts to protect those incumbents. And so that's my concern of what we sometimes see. I think, though, you know, I'd love to see a process in which bipartisan creates competitive districts, where bipartisan creates a process that is fair and transparent. And I, you know, would love to challenge you to accomplish that this year. I hope you do. But we're concerned about what we've seen in other states and what we've seen over the last 40 years in Minnesota, and that just has not been the case.
Representative Murphy.
And, Madam Chair, Mr. Dean, nonpartisan just means that, not just means, nonpartisan means that the people that drawing it up would not be Republican or Democrat or ever vote again.
Mr. Dean?
I don't think we're necessarily saying that. I mean, we all have personal political beliefs that we bring to the table, whether those are judges or whether those are people in the nonprofit community. But what I think it's important is, and the reason that we're advocating for this sort of level of nonpartisanship in the process, is that really it gets after this self-interest issue that I think former Speaker Swigum talked about last week, and former Vice President Mondale talked about last week. And it's really the goal is to address that self-interest problem. And they have identified really these nonpartisan judges because in Minnesota, well, we kind of have nonpartisan judges. I guess after the White decision, it's not necessarily the case. But that, at least with the retired judge pool, there's sort of an agreement to sort of behave in more of a nonpartisan manner where we think that those would be more ideal decision makers when it comes to developing these maps.
Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Madam Chair, Mr. Dean, and then in the nonpartisan judge pool, we're not going to remember if they were appointed by Governor Ventura, Governor Perpich, or Governor Anderson, or Governor Pawlenty. Is that correct? We're not going to go through the names and look and see who appointed them.
Mr. Dean.
But again, if you remember how the process is created in terms of how the members are selected, there is party balance as part of that, where the leadership of both political parties get to choose which judge gets put on the panel. And then basically the four choose a fifth final sort of judge as part of that process.
Representative Murphy.
Political, but it was a good point. I think you just said that this committee would be able, because we're balanced, if two of those people would leave, we would be balanced then, and we could have come just exactly what you asked for.
Mr. Dean.
And we're saying, I'm saying, not we, I'm saying that from the conversations that Representative Anderson and I have had, we think we're going to be able to get a plan that's approved by the legislature, developed and approved by the legislature, with input, of course, from the public, which we started out to do and which you applauded us for. Thanks.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dean, I just had a question about the, I guess your idea of a coalition, you call it independent and nonpartisan. How does this idea really ensure that the plan's not going to end up in court like we've seen in past years?
Mr. Dean.
There's nothing that guarantees it. The issue and the reason why I think this is a better process is, one, the group is likely to come to some sort of agreement. These are sort of elder statesmen and women as part of the state who understand the process and don't have inherent conflict of interest in that process, being retired judges. So they understand the legal requirements of it, where they're less likely then to get challenged in court. And the second is they're less likely to create districts that are to one party's advantage over the other. And so that's why we think that it's an ideal process and why it's less likely to end up in the courts.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dean, you said that they would come to some sort of an agreement. I guess in my mind I'm thinking that typically it would be maybe one of the political parties that would be suing over this plan. Are these guys going to be actually negotiating with the political parties, or what do you mean by some sort of agreement?
Mr. Dean.
Because, again, you have some level of party balance within the redistricting process in terms of these judges are appointed by the leadership of both the House and the Senate, that you're going to have a process in which should have general buy-in because, again, of the individuals that are developing the process or developing the final map, that these are trusted community members sort of making that decision and making a decision in a more viewpoint-neutral manner, basically. Because, again, these individuals don't have self-interest in the process, unlike the way that the current process is set up. And so because of that, I think any individual that would challenge it in court would have an extremely high burden to overcome because of, one, the level of the individuals making these decisions, the five retired judges, and then, two, just the level of, I think, community buy-in that will exist in this type of process.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dean, when you're talking about, under the guise of kind of keeping this out of court, and you use the term coming to an agreement, who are they agreeing with to keep this out of court?
Mr. Dean.
They're agreeing within, amongst themselves, as sort of five former judges within the court. And so I think, again, they bring a level of experience to it that maybe this committee doesn't necessarily hold in terms of understanding the legal ramifications. Because, again, for anything to be challenged in court, there has to be a clear violation of the law, some sort of violation of Section 8, violations of Minnesota Constitution. And I think that these judges really sort of would understand that process more so than potentially members here, that they're less likely to end up in those type of problems that you've seen in the past. I mean, a clear example is in 1990, when the map was rushed through, there were problems of contiguity, basically, where maps or districts were not connected together. Clear violation of the law. And so that's why the 90 plan was challenged, obviously for a variety of other reasons, but you run into those type of issues. And so I think having those retired judges bring a level of experience and knowledge of the process that doesn't exist in the current process.
Representative Dowd.
So you don't see anything that would necessarily keep this out of court? I mean, it could be just as likely this plan would end up in court as our current system.
Mr. Dean.
No, I would disagree. I actually think it's less likely to end up in court because of the level of knowledge and experience that these individuals bring to the process and because of the lack of inherent conflict of interest that exists with these individuals then too.
Well, Mr. Dean, I guess I'm kind of confused by those statements because in another portion of your handout that you have here, you say that the courts lack the transparency and desire for public input that is necessary. So in one case, you're arguing that judges are the place to be, but in another case, you're saying, no, we don't want them in charge of this. Can you explain?
The proposal that's been brought forward by Senator Pogrom-Miller, and actually the Carlson-Mondale Commission is really the best group to identify this with, they've actually identified a separate process that is actually outside of the court process. And so I think we need to sort of make that clear, that there's sort of the current process, which is legislators handle it, and there's a backup option that goes immediately to the courts. They've created a new option that actually doesn't deal with the courts directly, that it's retired judges that sit on this commission and develop the process. As part of that, though, and as part of the legislation, there's requirements of greater transparency and greater citizen input that doesn't necessarily exist in the current court process. And so I think because of that, it is an ideal process over what we currently have.
Well, Mr. Dean, it's the same folks that are going to be doing it. I don't know what makes them change overnight just because they're retired versus being sitting judges on the bench. So I guess I'm just kind of curious about that. Members, anybody else that has questions? Representative Hortman.
Well, I do have a question, but I don't need to ask it. I was wondering if there are other people who were going to be I didn't want to prolong this part if we have a lot of other people who are going to testify.
Oh, well, go ahead, Representative Hortman.
Thank you for being here. I think it's a really valuable proposal for us to be talking about. And I think the reason why it's a valuable proposal is the public doesn't trust us. And I think what you're hearing from members of the committee is, you know, there's an inherent insult to legislators of saying you can't do it and you can't be fair. And so I think that you're getting a little bit of a reaction from that. But I think the problem is the public doesn't trust us, and the question is how do we make sure that the public trusts it and that they have more confidence in the product, and so they're less likely to litigate. And I think, you know, you've identified a couple of ways we could do that. The two ways that I'm most interested in are the principles and taking in a lot of public input. And on the issue of the principles, the one that I think is kind of interesting that you talked about and we haven't really talked about here yet is the issue of competition. Representative Garofalo was talking about in places where it's impossible to make a competitive district, but I live in an area where it's not impossible. You can draw my area as a DFL district or a Republican district or a competitive district. And I want you to talk a little bit about the value of competitiveness in a district and what you think that adds to the process. I personally think that's a value that we should have as a part of our principles, but I know there are other members of this committee who don't think competitiveness belongs as one of the principles. So I'm curious about your thoughts of why you included that.
Mr. Dean?
I think without competition, it's hard to have accountability. And there's been a lot of talk about accountability over in this process right now. And so what you would do would be one of the criteria that you consider, and you'd look at basically previous voting history of individuals and try to create districts so that there were a large number of competitive districts. This, again, was something that former Governor Ventura really tried to champion during the last redistricting process. And despite his failings, I think it's really commendable sort of the process that he really tried to lay out during the redistricting process, because he understood, you know, if we follow the California model, which was legislators creating their own districts, and we have this sort of detente that too often has existed, it's really hard for average citizens to have their voice heard in that process. And so that if you make it a part of the criteria, you make it part of the job of the legislators to create districts that are competitive, then it really decreases the likelihood. No matter what happens, you're going to create DFL districts that are predominantly going to be elected by DFLers, and the same with Republicans. It's just how this state sort of works. But if you can make it more of a focus to try to create a larger number of competitive districts, then I think you're going to help build more public trust in that process too. And I think that's the frustration that we hear all the time, and why you see these type of citizen-based referendums passing in so many states like California and Florida and even in Minneapolis this year, where, again, it's fairly one-party control. There's frustration that the political parties, you know, don't necessarily have people's best interests in mind, that really if you have more competitiveness, you have accountability, you have legislators that are more willing to listen to the concerns of individuals.
Representative Hortman.
Another question I have is about the drawing lines without regard to where incumbents live, and that makes a lot of sense on the surface. But one thing that I have understood to be a problem in the past is that some of the processes draw lines where a large number of women lose their seats or a large number of minorities lose their seats. And so it seems to me there's a conflict between ignoring where incumbents live, but also following the Voting Rights Act so that you're not disenfranchising maybe minority representation. And I don't know if in putting together the principles, if you guys talked about the conflict there with, you know, looking at where incumbents live and also the Voting Rights Act problems.
Well, Mr. Dean.
Let me just be clear about these principles here that we outline on this particular page. These are not necessarily agreed upon principles of the coalition. These are issues that I think other states have looked into and have considered, and I think it's important that the committee look at some of these issues and consider at least as part of the process. Regarding sort of the incumbent neutrality, though, you raise a very good point that, and often you'll see, and as you move forward with the redistricting process, some of the criteria often at odds with each other. And so it's important then, as you create those criteria, to then also put them in priority order. And so what is the most critical? And probably the most critical is equal population. That is sort of a requirement. And so as the committee moves forward to put those criteria together, put them in priority order, and try to follow that as best you can, but with the realization that at some point you're going to have criteria that are in conflict, and that's why you have them in priority order.
Representative Horman.
Just a comment on the issue of competitiveness, because my opinion on it is that if you have competitive districts, you have members of the body who are more able to and willing to find the middle ground. And so it's a different articulation of the value of competitiveness that you had than what I have. But I think it's a value that this committee should debate, whether it's in principles we put into statute. And, you know, I might be the only one who thinks it's something we should put into statute, but it's an interesting issue to discuss what it really means and how it could benefit the state or not benefit the state.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Dean. And then I understand that we have League of Women Voters would like to, a representative from there would like to come and speak. And if you can please come to the testifier table and state your name for the record. Okay. Welcome, and Mr. Dean, if you can stick around, and then anybody else that is interested in speaking, if you could kind of come forward and be ready in queue here. So go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Laura Frederick Wang. I am the Interim Executive Director with the League of Women Voters Minnesota, mm-hmm. And we also have several people with us today who represent various communities around the state who would like to talk about how redistricting could impact their community. I am also here as a member of one of the coalition partners for Draw the Line Minnesota, a growing group of nonpartisan, nonprofit organizations that recognize the vital importance.
Ms. Wang?
Yes.
Would it be, because it looks like you're going to read through the letter that we have received?
Yes.
You know what? Would it be possible if you have any other comments other than that? I've read through this letter. I encourage the members to read through it as well. But just for a time's sake, is there anything in addition to this that you would like to submit to us today?
I think the main thing that I just want to underscore is that we really believe that the key principles that the committee needs to look at are transparency, accountability, and citizen participation. Regardless of who draws the map, I think that those are very critical pieces so that the citizens of Minnesota feel like their voices were heard and that they're going to be well represented in the decade to come. But we do have several people who came a long distance, and I want to make sure that they get a chance to testify.
Excellent.
So I will be here for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Wang.
Thanks.
Could you please state your name for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Sally Finde. I'm here representing the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, where I am a member. And I'm also here representing Native Vote Alliance Minnesota, which is a nonprofit organization. We're the only nonprofit organization in the state of Minnesota that does civic engagement work in American Indian communities statewide. The reason that I'm here today is because of the fact that I think that since 1924, the American Indian people in this country have been kind of shifted back and forth. And until 1924, we had no right to vote here in the United States. And since then, I think it's very important to us, because of that, we always have a voice at the public policy table. Now, if you haven't noticed, you know, in the Minnesota legislature, there are zero American Indian representatives. So, and we haven't had a representative since 1850 with the territorial legislature. So I think that for us, our voice truly needs to be heard. And because of the fact that we live in rural Minnesota, It's devastating to us at times. I live in an area where the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, it's 10,000 members and it's 4,000 to 5,000 voters, actually have four different counties that they deal with: Beltrami, Hubbard, Itasca, and Cass. And I also know that Boys Fort, which is a small community, smaller than the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, with approximately less than 1,000 probably voters, one of their streets in their American Indian communities is separated by a district. The district line is drawn one side of the block and the other side, and it's a small Indian community. So that's why I think that it's really important for Indian people in Minnesota to be at the table, that you ask us what our opinions are, and hopefully that we will, in this redistricting process, be at the table.
Thank you, Ms. Finday. And we have reached out to different tribes and have received feedback back from them, and that's actually posted on the website. So this is helpful that you've provided this letter with us today as well. So thank you. Representative Murphy, you have a question?
One question. In those four counties that you said you were dealing with four counties on the reservation, is there just one representative?
Ms. Finday.
Representing the reservation, or do you have more than one?
For the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, there's two. We would have, that's they're split in 4A and 4B, so they don't, their voice is split in two, so it really makes it quite difficult to have representation.
Representative Murphy. Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
And if you could please state your name for the record.
Sure. My name is Monica Meyer, and I'm the Executive Director of Outfront Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify. So I'm going to be brief. Outfront Minnesota, we've been around since 1987, and we advocate for equality for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender Minnesotans. And we do that through public policy, education, and training, legal advocacy, and as well as we work in anti-violence issues. So thank you so much for allowing me to be here today. So we're a part of the Draw the Line Minnesota campaign because we believe it's important for all Minnesotans to be fairly represented in our government, and that our communities deserve the right to participate in an open and transparent redistricting process. District lines can keep people with common interests together or split us apart. Depending on which people are bundled together in a district, the district lines can make it much easier or much harder to elect any given representative or to elect a representative responsible to any given community. For the GLBT community, the ability to be heard in the redistricting process is particularly important because our population is not visible through the U.S. Census. So in 2000, that was the first time where same-sex couples were actually asked to come out in the census and actually declare themselves as household members and families. And we found through that process that there are same-sex couples that live in every county in the state. And we'll find out more what happened in the last census. So we're all over the state, but the problem with the census often is that it undercounts GLBT people because it only counts family-headed households and not individuals or people who are living separate than their partners. The court decisions in Minnesota require that the redistricting process must recognize, preserve, and be accountable to real communities or communities of interest. And the GLBT community is definitely a community of interest. While these terms aren't well defined, it is generally accepted that communities of interest are groups of people concentrated in a geographic area that share similar interests and priorities, whether social, cultural, ethnic, racial, or religious. And the way that the GLBT communities will be recognized in the redistricting process is through an open process that allows for engagement of our communities. Communities of interest should not be viewed as special interests. Nearly half of the states around the country have redistricting criteria, which include consideration of community of interest for state legislative districts, some expressly set forth in their state constitution even. Preserving communities of interest have long been recognized as a traditional districting criterion by the Supreme Court and is a redistricting criterion that's even older than the Voting Rights Act. We encourage you to adopt principles in your redistricting process that prioritize preserving communities of interest, that allow public input and review of all data, testimony, and maps you are considering. And this is critical to creating districts that reflect the real communities we all live in, and allow communities the opportunity to elect representatives who will be truly responsible to their concerns. And thanks a lot for the opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Members, questions? If you can state your name for the record.
Sure, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Adam Fitek. First of all, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to testify. I'm speaking as a former member of CHANCE, and CHANCE stands for Cedar Humphrey Action for Neighborhood Collaborative Engagement. And Chance is a partnership between the Humphrey School and the Cedar Riverside neighborhood in Minneapolis. It focuses on strengthening the relationship between the University of Minnesota, students there, and then also Cedar Riverside residents and then business owners through civic engagement. As a member of Chance, I worked with Cedar Riverside leaders, particularly community, leaders of the Somali community, providing education, outreach, and preparation for the 2010 census. As the work evolved over several months, I saw how community members became more engaged, providing leadership and taking pride in making sure that their friends and family were counted in the 2010 census. By the end, many had taken over aspects of this outreach work. They were providing communication in Somali, Oromo, Vietnamese, and other non-English languages to help educate their neighbors that did not understand the many messages that were being broadcast in English. As outreach for the census ended in May, I performed focus groups with those that led the outreach. Many again spoke of greater pride in their neighborhood. In addition, many felt embraced by the work that they had done, seeing how they could impact their neighborhood through civic engagement. As this commission begins its work on redistricting, I ask that you consider the important principles laid out by the Minnesota and how they impact communities like the Cedar Riverside neighborhood. Chief among those, and those that would most affect communities like the ones I worked in, is the preservation of communities of interest within the process. Communities like the Cedar Riverside neighborhood feel and see a benefit of their engagement to the community. A redistricting process that would divide up these communities would inversely affect that engagement, leaving them underrepresented and really losing a sense of empowerment. Secondly, one of the most important issues that I learned from the outreach that I did was really the institutional knowledge that these communities have. I mean, they really know what's best for them. As I worked on messaging for the 2010 census, I quickly learned from community leaders that national messages about the census were not necessarily the messages that resonated with members of that community. Just like the census, redistricting is a process that should include the voices of all neighborhoods, and as they are the ones with the institutional knowledge to understand what is best for them. The redistricting process should therefore include meaningful engagement of diverse communities, both to define their communities before the map-making process begins, which you guys have already done, and a minimum of 2 weeks after the maps are drawn, really for communities like Cedar Riverside to voice their concerns. A lack of public input into this process reduces the voices of communities that are already underrepresented. Thank you for giving me the time to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Fitek. Did I say that right?
Fitek.
Fitek. Yep. Members, any questions? Thank you. If you could please state your name for the record.
Good evening. My name is Jeff Narrowbrook. I'm with the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me time to speak. The Council of Nonprofits is a member association of the state's 501c3 nonprofit organizations. We are 2,000 members across the state. We span all cities, counties, regions, and legislative districts. And I'm here to ask that the committee see nonprofits as partners in their work in engaging the public on redistricting, just as the nonprofit partners that you've heard from today. And we also ask that there be numerous public input opportunities be afforded so that communities can participate in the dialogue. Lastly, we ask that the committee review public input to make decisions and that there be transparency in those dialogues so that the citizens really understand how their input was used and maybe why or why it was not prioritized when the map was drawn. As organizations that exist to strengthen communities, nonprofits are eager to promote civic engagement. Adam mentioned a little bit about the work done around the 2010 census, and really believe nonprofits played a huge role in ensuring that especially hard-to-reach communities were counted in our state. Today, those same nonprofits stand ready to be allies in helping legislators craft districts that will serve our communities well, and particularly around this question of defining communities of interest. The preservation of communities of interest or groups of people concentrated in a geographic area that share similar interests or priorities is an important criterion when drawing districts, in part because when you preserve these communities, districts are created with particular and identifiable interests that elected officials can be responsive to when they come to the legislature. The scope of what constitutes a community of interest is by nature open to interpretation, so a process of public input is definitely needed to define it. And though the task itself is straightforward enough, asking community members, how do you see your community, convening the public to have this discussion can be a challenge, and in particular when it comes to convening underrepresented communities. Nonprofits are already engaging community members, bringing them together that have shared interests. They may be social, cultural, ethnic, racial, economic, or religious in nature. So nonprofits are already convening communities. And by virtue of their missions, they bring a nonpartisan, community-centered focus to the redistricting dialogue. I think creating a space to have a really productive conversation about how citizens wish to be grouped with other voters. We don't necessarily expect such conversations to make the difficult choices that you have any easier. We know that there's lots of competing criteria that are valid, and in some ways more voices will likely increase the challenge and the hard decisions you need to make when you draw the lines. But what we do expect is that ample public input creates a process that respectfully acknowledges we all have a stake in the outcome, and frankly, I think one that goes well beyond the electoral outcomes of how a district is drawn. In a real sense, to draw a district is to draw a new community, a community of voters. And while we don't necessarily think of districts as a community, it really is. And since we all carry multiple identities, social, cultural, racial, and so on, if those identities don't, at least in some way, inform the creation of our voting community, then I think we'll have lost something really important. Once citizens have shared their input, it's vital that there be open and transparent access to the discussions among you all as you review the input and make decisions. And this way, citizens will know they've been heard by their elected officials, regardless of if they agree or disagree with the decisions that are ultimately made. So in short, MCN and our nonprofit members are eager to engage in this process, and we're really relying on the committee to create the mechanisms and the processes for doing so. We ask that the committee provide widespread opportunities for public input and create a process of meaningful and open discussion of the public input once they've received it. Thank you for your time. I'm happy to address any questions you have about nonprofits' role in redistricting.
Well, thank you. Narrowbrook?
Narrowbrook, yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Narrowbrook. Representative Murphy?
Madam Chair, Mr. Narrowbrook, so what happens if this committee decides that we want you to be our partner and Mr. Freeman calls you? Then what happens? And he says, we want you to be our partner and we need your input soon.
Okay.
On Wednesday, on Friday morning, on Tuesday.
Mr. Narrowbrook?
What happens then?
Madam Chair, Representative, it would be a challenge. I do see us as being a key ally in getting people to these meetings. I don't know how the meetings that you've held have gone in terms of turnout. I think it's difficult to get people there. But I think not. What we can do, what we know is that nonprofits are interested. We're more than willing to ask them to promote this to their communities. And I think the unique thing about going through nonprofits is that you put out a call to the general public and maybe there's not a sense of community there. Certainly there would be, you know, I live in this city or town, but with nonprofits, there's already people coming around the shared sense of identity, and so I think there's more motivation for them to come together in that sense maybe and show up to a meeting. But we can't guarantee people will come, but we believe our members are ready to at least encourage people to attend.
Representative Murphy?
Madam Chair, Mr. Narrowbrook, would you, if we sent you some questions and said, get the answers back to us for Northeast, Northwest, Central, Southeast, Southwest, Minnesota, would you reach out to your membership then and then get various answers and then combine them and tally them and get them back to us?
Madam Chair, Representative, we'd be absolutely thrilled to do something along those lines.
You've got a network?
Detail, but yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We're a statewide organization. We have several chapters across the state. We are all over the state, and we'd be thrilled to get solicit feedback on those things from our members.
Thank you.
Representative Murray. Well, Mr. Narrowbrook, and I assume that you guys have already done this, that you've forwarded on to your leaders of the different nonprofit entities that you represent our committee schedule. I'm assuming that you have directed them to the website that contains all of our committee meeting minutes and all the information that we've used so far. I'm assuming that you have directed them to the GIS website, too, that has all the information about state redistricting as well as all the data that we have on state demographics and population estimates that we have to date Is that correct, Mr. Narrowbrook? Or?
Madam Chair, that's correct. We have promoted the existing resources.
Excellent. Great. Wonderful. Members, any other questions? And is that wrap us up, Mr. Dean? Okay. Members, any other questions for Mr. Dean? I just almost promoted you there. What do you think about that? Great. Well, thank you so much, members. We are adjourned.